You're listening to Robert Wright's Non-Zero Podcast.
Hello, Glenn.
Hey, Bob.
How you doing?
I'm doing famously well, Robert. Very well indeed. Can't complain.
Is your wellness famous? Really? You mean around your house? Let me introduce this. I'm Robert Wright, publisher of the Non-Zero Newsletter. This is the Non-Zero Podcast. You are Glenn Lowry, famous public intellectual, distinguished economist at Brown, host of the legendary Glenn Show, author of Late Admissions, an excellent memoir that I recommend. And, you know, of particular relevance to the conversation we're about to have, which is going to get into Israel and Gaza and free speech and speech codes, is I think your latest book, right? This about self-censorship?
It's called Self-Censorship. And yes, it's a small book, an essay that I published back in the 90s that people have called prescient, that has been refurbished and surrounded by a foreword and an afterword in which I discuss the problem of speaking one's mind candidly in public when you know that people are going to make judgments about you based on what they hear.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And this has become an issue for you lately around the issue of Gaza and Israel. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, that's fair to say. I mean, it's an issue around a number of issues. I mean, I worry about how I talk about President Donald Trump, about how I talk about the conflict in Ukraine, about how I talk about affirmative action, being an African-American. About how I talk about religion, being a former confessing Christian who lost his faith. I mean, depending on the context, different issues will be more or less salient. And the generic phenomenon that I'm trying to analyze in the book is the way in which the foreknowledge that what one says will be examined and scrutinized for evidence of what one, quote, really believes. The consequences of that kind of pressure for the choices that a person has to make about what they say and how they say it and whether to say anything at all. And yes, the Israel-Gaza conflict is an arena in which I have felt especially constrained because people have such strong feelings about it. And one has to be very careful what one says, what words one uses, what generalizations and comparisons one makes and draws. And, you know, it's fraught. It's a very fraught, discursive environment.
It is. And one reason, because, I mean, you just alluded to this thing where people try to infer on the basis of what you said, whether there's more they can say about your actual beliefs or your actual character beyond what you said. And of course, with the Israel issue, the standard accusation is that you're anti-Semitic if you criticize Israel harshly and get taken to task for it. Now, you were on the Tucker Carlson show a few months ago and talked about a price that apparently you had paid. I'm not even sure it's so much for what you said as for some guests you had on your show, right? I mean, you, at that point, your show had a kind of sponsorship from the Manhattan Institute, as I recall, and you, kind of separate from that, were a fellow at the Manhattan Institute, I guess, and getting a stipend or something. Tell me if I've gotten anything wrong, and then if you can just recap the story.
No, you got it basically right. I had a relationship with the Manhattan Institute, which was remunerative for me. I was, in effect, a consultant. I was a senior fellow, not resident in Manhattan, but, you know, collecting a non-trivial stipend. And they were generously supporting the podcast with resources that I helped to underwrite. The cost of carrying my team of able associates, whom you are intimately familiar with.
Mm-hmm.
So it was an integral part. The Manhattan Institute relationship was an integral part of my sort of platform. I mean, I am now retired emeritus professor at Brown University effective July 1st of this year. But I was not at the time. And as I envisioned the transition into a post-professorial retirement, the Manhattan Institute was an important part of that picture in my planning. And yeah, they severed our relationship and did so in stages, as you suggest, first withdrawing support for the podcast and then asking me to find greener pastures as a senior fellow, which happily I'm able to report that I have done. And I now am affiliated with the Hoover Institution, where I'm a distinguished visiting fellow of a venerable West Coast organ, although not in residence. But in any case, that's something I said. I think it might have been a combination of things. I had Omer Bartov, the historian of the Holocaust, who's my colleague here at Brown University and who has a noteworthy piece. The piece was published after I had him on the show, but he was already the center of some controversy because he's a student of genocide. And he was concerned shortly after the war broke out in October of 2023 that Israel's prosecution of the war in Gaza and the political context of that had the risk of, he said at, early on, it wasn't quite what he would call a genocide, but it had genocide-like characteristics that he was worried about. And now he has eventually taken up the position, although, as I say, after I had him on the show, that you know, he says in the New York Times, "I know genocide, I study genocides. Sorry to have to report this to you, but this is a genocide." This is Omer Bartov. He's Jewish, he's an Israeli, as it happens, an historian. Writes about the Nazi extermination campaign in Eastern Europe in granular detail. He writes these books. I haven't read his books. I had him on the show. And was asked by the staff at the Manhattan Institute not to mention in promoting that show that I was sponsored by the Manhattan Institute. And there was
Had been a standard thing. I mean, their brand was on your show every time. And exactly. They said, "Can you take it off for this episode?"
Indeed. They asked me to de-escalate the association for this particular show. Subsequently, Ta-Nehisi Coates, the writer's book, The Message, came out. It's a collection of essays on writing, and one of them is about his experience on the West Bank, seeing the occupation in Israel, Palestine. And he wrote critical of the occupation in that book. And McWhorter, my conversation partner at the podcast, and I got into a back and forth about it, in which I acknowledged that I admired the writing. I thought it was both artful and also probative and morally serious and, you know, something that one should read. That I don't think went over very well. It certainly didn't go over well in the comments section, but I didn't hear anything from the Manhattan Institute people about that. But then I had another guest on to talk about a report by a UK-based research group called Air Wars that chronicles civilian casualties and aerial bombardment campaigns in contemporary warfare, and that had put out a report saying that the civilian casualties engendered by the IDF bombardment campaign in Gaza were disproportionate, and that that suggested a collective punishment characterization of the campaign being appropriate. And I had this young guy from the London School of Economics who was associated with the report on to talk about it, and along with Eli Lake, the journalist and
I know Eli,
Israel-friendly guy who writes for the Free Press and so who's a veteran correspondent covering the Middle East affairs. And so he was, quote, the other side, and they went back and forth, but I had him on the show. Anyway, the long and short of it is, after that, I got a notification that not only were they not going to continue to support the podcast, but that they were parting company with me effective the end of the relevant period. So they severed the relationship. We now, do I know that it was my Gaza reporting that was at the root of it? No, but it's, yeah, I can't prove it, but I know it's true, kind of thing.
Yeah, and you alluded to the fact that I know some of the people who work for you. And I've actually seen, you know, kind of the timeline. I mean, you recited it in more detail on Tucker's show, but I've seen an even more fine-grained version of it. And yeah, the evidence seems pretty compelling. I mean, there are three different things. Can you take our branding off of this episode? And then we're going to end the sponsorship of the show, and then we're going to end the sponsorship of you. We're going to end your stipend. And if you look at the timing, suggestive, I would say, to put it mildly. The other thing I'd say is, I mean, you talked about this on Tucker Carlson's show. You mentioned Rehan Salam, the president of the Manhattan Institute, and how he got in touch with you and so on. And they never denied this, right? I mean, they I'm sure that got their attention.
No, they didn't deny it. Rehan said in the letter, he didn't actually speak with me directly about separating, that they examined their fellowship associations for productivity and shared values, or words to that effect. So, I mean, that was an indirect statement that, I mean, it certainly wasn't productivity, because I, you know, been producing and writing in their magazine and participating in their webinars and, you know, doing the podcast, which is generating traffic and attention for the Manhattan. I was pulling my weight, to be sure. So if it wasn't productivity, it must have been shared values that I was falling short of.
Yeah, and the chairman emeritus of the Manhattan Institute is Paul Singer, who, and I think he's been a donor, who's, you know, kind of famously staunchly pro-Israel. I believe he some of his money was behind the Weekly Standard, and so yeah, it wouldn't shock me. I mean, I actually was not aware of the Manhattan Institute kind of weighing in on Israel a lot. I think of them as doing mainly domestic policy, but anyway, yeah, it's conservative, and Paul Singer in particular is associated with pro-Israel causes. So you've had a chance to reflect on this, and I gather that, well, maybe you should back up and just ask you a little bit about your feelings about the Gaza war, or America's relationship with Israel, or whatever else you want to talk about, because I know that as you began highlighting at least some of these voices on your show who were critical of Israel, you got a certain amount of blowback from your some of the viewers and listeners of the Glenn Show, which, you know, historically had been, had, I guess you could say, a right of center audience, in particular, kind of anti-woke audience. In a certain sense, an anti-speech code audience, right? I mean, that to me is a little bit of an irony associated with getting blowback from them, just in the sense that a lot of the anti-woke energy was expressed as anti-speech code energy. There are these things you're not allowed to say on campus, and that's not right, because a campus should be a place where you can say whatever you want. And now, you know, you're on the other, in a certain sense, you're on the other side of a speech code issue, right?
Well, that's an interesting way of put it, particularly given that my little book, Self-Censorship, is just out. Look, I'm not going to be able to give you a carefully articulated critical assessment of the war. I just thought too many civilians were being killed, too many atrocities were being reported. The tone of the discussion that I heard coming out of this Israeli leadership about what they were doing in Gaza was disquieting. And we could parse the different issues, you know, tunnels, civilian human shields, Hamas. I just thought this is an asymmetric confrontation. They're in effect shooting fish in a barrel. Call me a sentimental, soft-hearted sap. I can't bear it. I can't bear it. And the triumphalism and the supremacism. I just made the word up. Rubbed me the wrong way. I thought the human shield argument was absurd. I thought it asked way too much of me. I'm not responsible for wreaking havoc here because the other guy put a baby up in front of me and I had to go through the baby to get to him. You know, I thought, okay, maybe from your perspective, Israel's perspective, this is necessary. I'm an American, and it's not necessary for me to help you do it.
Mm-hmm.
I thought, you dare me to actually invoke the context within which October 7th in particular, but the whole struggle that is generations old has arisen? Because there's a pat, fixed, straight narrative about that which leaves you righteous in whatever you do? And I can't raise any question about that? It rubbed me the wrong way. Yeah, my audience is relatively conservative, and I think we're attracted because McWhorter and I were tearing down the Ibram X. Kendi's of the world and the Nicole Hannah Joneses of the world, didn't have anything good to say about the 1619 Project, didn't like affirmative action, were death on reparations for slavery and all of that, all those nostrums and those characters, and would take them down a notch or two. And I think people, you know, I'm a national treasure, they would say in the comments. I may help them maintain their sanity when George Floyd riots were breaking out and I was saying, cool it to the rioters. So they had certain expectations. And my deviance on this question, my sense of disquiet, I mean, it's not as if I'm pro-Hamas. But to say that I was pro-Palestinian, okay, maybe. Do I see the humanity of the Palestinians? Sure, I sure do. Do I feel anguish at their suffering? Yes. Yes, I do. Am I sympathetic to their aspiration? I mean, how could I not be? All they want is self-determination and, you know, whatever. You're going to say they want to push the Jews into the sea? I'm going to say it's very convenient of you to characterize their humanity in that way when you got your foot on their neck. So it left a bad taste in my mouth, Robert. I mean, I honestly, you know, I'm not taking a sort of anti-Zionist stand here. It's almost like I'm saying, I use this in something I said early on my own show. If my neighbor next door had a squatter problem, people were in his property and he didn't want them in there, and he pulled out a machine gun and he started gunning them down. He's my neighbor, and I certainly have sympathy because I don't want the squatters coming into my place, but can I at least object to the slaughter?
Or say I'm not going to provide the bullets?
Yeah.
You know, because, you know, one thing people say in response to the kind of thing you just said is, well, there are atrocities happening in country X and country Y, and you're not talking about those. And no, but America isn't sending the weapons and giving the country cover in the UN and everywhere else and saying, you know, sure, you go ahead, attack whatever your country you want. We'll have your back. We'll attack them too, in fact, you know, which Trump did with Iran. And so, yeah, I mean, as you know, I cannot be your antagonist on this issue. I guess I can play devil's advocate. And there are a lot of ways to play devil's advocate. I mean, I've long said, you know, it's a little harder to say it now, but I started saying years ago, Israel is not responding to the threat they face any more crazily than America responded to 9/11 in terms of like level of over response. Now you might be able to argue that actually they are, but my point is, it would, if you lived in Israel, it would be easy to feel very threatened and to feel existentially threatened. I understand that. I just happen to think that in addition to being inhumane in the ways you described, what they're doing is not in the long-term interests of Israel or, for that matter, of Jews around the world. But that's just me.
I agree with that. I've talked to Peter Beinart about his book being Jewish after the destruction of Gaza, and he was very compelling to me in making that point.
Yeah, Peter's been on my show. We were colleagues at the New Republic. He, of course, he's Jewish and he's from South Africa. And I know he's not the only American Jew I know who is from South Africa, and for that reason has a special sensitivity to this issue. Tony Karen is another one who has a newsletter called Rootless Cosmopolitan. So have you talked like you're talking now, like on your show? You hosted a debate between Eli Lake and somebody else. Have you had debates with the Eli Lakes of the world? I actually had one with Eli right after October 7th. I like Eli a lot. But have you...
I have not. And I have been exhorted to do so and have been reluctant to do so, to be honest with you. And many mm-hmm. people have been suggested that I should have on to debate the issue. And I haven't felt like it's something I wanted to do.
Because of the reaction from your audience, you anticipate?
No. I think, you know, do I know enough to go toe-to-toe with somebody who does combat on this issue for a living? I guess I felt challenged by that. I thought, mm-hmm. I'm not really interested. I mean, this is one of the things that might have gotten me in trouble with MI after Eli Lake came on. I did one of these post-show conversations with Mark and Nikita in which they kind of talked to me about the show. And we put it up as bonus content. And, you know, I was asked, what did I learn from Eli Lake? And I said, what was I going to learn from him that was relevant to the thing? I mean, I already knew what he was going to say. So that is not exactly commendable in terms of the spirit of objective journalism, I know, but it's how I've decided to handle it.
You mean the decision not to pursue it much on your show? Or do you mean what you said about Eli?
That's what I mean. Yeah. That's what I mean. Yeah. It's not a theme that I've taken up at the show as such. It's something that has come up. I've had, you know, I've had the people on that I've mentioned that I've had, but they are, with the exception of Eli Lake and Noam Dworman.
Mm-hmm. I know Noam. I was just listening to his podcast last night.
Yeah.
Have you thought about talking to actual audience members? I mean, you must have people in your audience who are particularly outraged. Do you ever have like Zoom calls or anything?
Yeah, we're doing these live stream things once a week now for a couple of hours on a Friday evening. And I can think of the correspondent's name. The person who calls into the show, his name is Scott Kushner. Hmm. And he and I have had a back and forth about it. And he admires Glenn Lowry. He respects Glenn Lowry. But he wishes that I would take seriously the following set of considerations. And he allows that, you know, he makes the argument that he makes. Yeah. Another caller, his name is Mark Altshuler. You know, he said, the Jews have got guns this time. That's the line of his that I remember. Never again. Right. It's going to mean never again. We got guns this time. Hmm. And, well, you know.
Yeah, I think that captures a sense of threat that is not surprising given what happened in Germany in World War II. But again, I think can be counterproductive if the actual level of the threat you face is not kept in perspective. And right now, I don't think Israel faces any kind of security threat at all, with the possible exception of the blowback from the current policies. But that's just me. Now, the speech issue is kind of separate from all this. We've been talking about Gaza and Israel, but, you know, there's a separate question as to what does and does not constitute anti-Semitism or anti-Semitic speech. And that has been changing. I mean, you may remember when Jimmy Carter had a book called Palestine, Peace, Not Apartheid. And I believe in the book, he didn't even say Israel was practicing apartheid. And I will say, if you've been to the West Bank, you can see how someone could say that. I mean, you got roads the Palestinians can't drive on. You've got, you know, it's a lot of the hallmarks of
Yeah, that's what Ta-Nehisi Coates was writing about.
Yeah, no, he went there and was struck by some of the things I was struck by when I went there. But Carter, I don't think at that point was even saying that they were practicing apartheid. He was just saying, this is where it's headed in the West Bank. You know, you can't keep building these settlements without having to make a decision at one point. And I can see one road leading to flat out apartheid. And I don't know if you remember the controversy, but he had to apologize, basically walk it back. You know, the Anti-Defamation League, whose functions I think include enforcing a speech code about Israel, frankly. I don't know if you've had any run-ins with him, Glenn, but
not specifically, although I know that's what they do.
You know,
This is in the context of the United Nations resolution of equating Zionism with racism. I remember the World Conference Against Racism in Durban in 2001, that issue was drawn. The United States actually didn't send the Secretary of State, who was Colin Powell, an African-American, to South Africa to that conference because of that controversy. I think the use of the word apartheid, the evocation of South Africa, the implicit equivalency that's being drawn between the Israeli-Palestinian struggle, conflict on the one hand, and the struggle of Black South Africans for liberation, which, you know, had been successful and had been a response in response to world condemnation. You know, that's what I think is going on in terms of the vitriolic, hyperbolic reaction to any use of the term apartheid. I think the same with respect to the word genocide and its application to the campaign, the effects of the campaign in Gaza now. So I think there are taboos about words.
Yeah. Now, it is changing. I think really, honestly, you don't get into much trouble for the word apartheid anymore because they're so busy fighting off use of the word genocide, which I actually haven't applied to Gaza yet for reasons I won't get into. I mean, there's certainly war crimes being committed. Their forced displacement is a war crime. They seem to be bent on the wholesale ethnic cleansing of Gaza. There's ethnic cleansing going on in the West Bank. Genocide, I don't know. And I'm curious actually about your experience. I just grew up equating genocide with an attempt to actually exterminate a whole ethnic group. And, you know, what these people say is, well, they'd be happy for the Gazans to just leave Gaza, right? And that's true. That's not the same as killing them all, I guess. I think there's been an evolution in the discourse about international law as to the meaning of the word genocide. Is that your sense, that the word is more loosely applied now than it was 30, 40 years ago?
Yeah, you think about Rwanda or you think about the Nazi Holocaust, people being put in the ovens and gas chambers and so on. You don't think about a military campaign against the insurgency, a terrorist group, quote unquote, which has heavy civilian casualties. You don't necessarily think about that. I don't use the word myself. I'm not objecting to the use of the word, but it's not like I go run around saying, you support genocide of an American politician who votes for funds for military aid to Israel. But it's a test. The use of the word is a test. Like, can't I make some pretty valid inferences, at least roughly, about where a person stands on broader issues of Israel and Zionism and anti-Semitism from their willingness to use the word or their scrupulous avoidance of using it. So when I then think about the use of the word, it's not a technical definition. Does this fit within a certain Geneva Treaty's characterization of what it takes? Check the boxes 1, 2, 3. It's rather, am I one of those people? Am I one of the mm-hmm. people who are willing to be associated with the word? And that's kind of how I would analyze it from the point of view that I developed in this book that we've been talking about.
Yeah, no, given the way the word is used now, I don't think it's crazy to apply it to Gaza. I mean, the official position of the U.S. State Department is that China is committing a genocide, against the Uyghurs. And mm-hmm. These are very different kinds of situations, but I do think that on balance, and of course, we don't know as much about what's happened there as it would be good to know. But I had an expert on and talked about it and tried to get a sense. And it does seem to me, if you're going to call that genocide, although again, it's a little bit of an apples and oranges thing, it's certainly not crazy to call Gaza genocide. One reason I don't do it is because I imagine, like, being Israeli, and, you know, because to them, genocide means the Holocaust, understandably. It means, you know, rounding up millions of people and executing them, and so I can understand how they would react, like when you apply the word genocide to something that's very different, that it just makes it so easy for them to say, man, you do not understand the first thing about our history, do you? You do not understand the first thing about our situation.
And sure, because it's as if you're equating the one to the other, and they, right, of course, and perhaps rightly, think their experience is much more egregious.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, but I don't know. There's so many things. You know, the speech code has really loosened. It's weird. It has and it hasn't. On the one hand, there are things that you used to get into trouble for saying, like, it used to be that if you said what Israel does is contributing to anti-Semitism, that was considered, or you would be condemned for being anti-Semitic. That didn't make sense to me because although it's true that if someone becomes anti-Semitic or more anti-Semitic in response to something the Israeli government does, that doesn't make, it never makes sense to be a racist or bigot of any kind. But it doesn't make sense because Israel is the nation that is Zionist, but it's not all of the world's Jews. So if you hold the world's Jews responsible for something Israel does, that's a kind of conflation of Israel and the Jewish people. It doesn't make any sense, of course. But the fact is, you know that there are anti-Semites or potential anti-Semites who will in fact react that way. They will make that conflation. And yet, if you just said that, say, hey, I'm worried that certain Israeli policies will lead certain people by virtue of this illogical conflation to become more anti-Semitic, it used to be that that was actually condemned as anti-Semitism itself. But now I've heard, I think that that rule has changed. I've heard fairly pro-Israel Jews express concern about that. And so I guess it's legit. So the point is just the speech code changes. But at the same time, the means of enforcement of the speech code have in some ways, reached new levels of harshness in terms of some things the Trump administration is doing, trying to deport people for writing op-eds and, immigrants, of course. And I would say, getting university presidents. I'd be interested in your take on this as somebody who has been immersed in academia. Like, would you say that there has been the successful intimidation by the Trump administration and maybe in some cases by donors like Bill Ackman of professors? Has speech been chilled on campus among students or professors?
I don't have systematic evidence about it, but my impression is, and bear in mind that I am emeritus professor here at Brown now, is that yes, it has been that people are being careful because they know that they're being watched. I think the fact that the presidents of Columbia, Harvard, Penn, MIT, they've all come under the gun. Elisa Stefanik asked whether having the chant "From the River to the Sea," which she construes as calling for the genocide of the Jewish people, is contrary to acceptable speech governance at their institutions. And they give a legalistic answer, depending on the context, using those words might or might not be protected speech. Zohran Mamdani is now being asked to give an account of his refusing to condemn, this kind of thing. Anyway, your question was chill on the climate of expression in universities, and I think so. I'm here at Brown. There's a Middle Eastern Studies department. It's pro-Palestinian. I think that's not disputable in its general tone. There's somebody who has a newsletter, which is all about how anti-Semitic is the Middle Eastern Studies department at Brown. It circulates. And, if I were a faculty member in that department, it's like an enemies list. I mean, my name is on the list. And the president of the university is constantly being harangued about why do you tolerate this kind of presence in your midst and all of that. I actually had lunch with a guy, a young man whose name I don't remember now, a young 40-year-old academic who's a director of the Brown Middle Eastern Studies. So he's a very mild-mannered and unassuming guy, very decent guy. Hardly a flaming terrorist supporting radical, but he has to manage an environment in which that kind of pressure is being brought to bear. I can't imagine, but that it doesn't affect what students say. I mean, in the classroom, you have Jewish students, they're outspoken. They are very opinions of in terms of their commitment to Zionism and their defense of the actions of the Israeli state. You don't want to gratuitously offend your students or make them feel unwelcome or unsafe. I would be loath to go on a rant like the one that I did earlier in this conversation in front of my students for that reason.
Do you have any sense for, I mean, you often hear that older American Jews are pretty, by and large, pretty pro-Israel, but it's a very different story among younger American Jews. I mean, certainly judging by the Jewish friends of my daughters who are on the left, you would think that that's the case. I mean, they all went to the same pro-ceasefire demonstrations and everything. But do you have a sense for what, like, the ratio is of, college, these would be college-age American Jews at Brown? And, of course, Brown historically has been left of the average Ivy League school, I guess. But do you have any sense for the relative frequency of pro-Israel versus...
Not a quantitative estimate, 2-1, 3-1. I think there's a range of opinion. I have a Jewish student who's a very sympathy and passion for the Zionist cause, complaining to me about her Jewish friends who are shunning her, not inviting her to social events and whatnot because she's, quote, a Zionist, close quote. These are Jewish, all Jewish people. I mean, my impressions are based upon what people are willing to say in the classroom. And I don't know everybody's ethnic identity. I'm not going to ask them, are you Jewish or not? Mm-hmm. Some of people will say, as a Jewish person, I think this or that. But you can have your suspicions based on names and all of that. But I don't know. I just know that when there was a takeover of the sit-in at the president's office and students were taken into custody and led to a bus that the authorities had assembled outside the building and taken away, a lot of them were Jewish.
You said you had, it sounded like you'd had some interaction with people in your audience at the Glenn show who were not wild about some of the views about Gaza that had been aired either on your show or even by you. I think I asked you this, but I believe it was before we started taping wrong, but have you tried engaging them in just the free speech part of just the speech code part of the question? Whatever you think about Israel and Hamas, if you opposed the attempt by the woke to impose a speech code on campuses, do you or do you not oppose what President Trump has done with respect to pro-Palestinian speech or criticism of Israel on American campuses? Has that issue been aired?
It has not in any kind of systematic way. If you're asking me, would I oppose it? Absolutely, I do oppose it. And I do think that there's an irony here, particularly for me, because I've built a following based upon advocating for free speech. I can remember in 2020, after George Floyd died, was killed by Derek Chauvin, my university president wrote a Dear Colleague letter that she sent around to the university community, the alumni, students, as well as faculty and staff. And she basically said the values of this university are the same as the values of the Black Lives Matter movement. She didn't say it in those words, but that's kind of was the message. And I thought this is a terrible thing, and I spoke out against it. The silencing of conservative voices on campus is something that I've inveighed against, and I think a viewpoint diversity is a really important component of putting together an intellectual community that is able to meet all of our responsibilities effectively. So on. And I, on the race questions, as I've already indicated, been a critic of the woke's mantras that are nearly universally affirmed on university campuses are, you know, again, 90-10 kind of a disproportion against expression of those views. So I, you know, Yeah. So speaking up in a way that's critical of Israel, leading to cancellation or condemnation or the accusation of being anti-Semitic, or the administrative imposition of the university in, you know, the case of op-ed writer being deported, or the Middle East Studies departments being put in receivership. We don't like that the way that Columbia University's Middle East Studies department teaches settler colonialism. We want to do something about that. It seems to me those are clear line crossing interventions that are attempting to control what's being said. I would even go so far as to say that the condemnation of student protest against what's going on in Gaza, not the objection to students occupying buildings or preventing people from getting into class, but just the idea that they would assemble and would give voice to they're pro Hamas, they're terrorist lovers, right, or things like that. That's very unfortunate, in my opinion.
Yeah. Now you probably know Barry Weiss, right?
Yeah, I know Barry Weiss.
I've never met her. I've written about her, and I emailed her after what I wrote and didn't hear back. But understandably, but I've always thought she kind of represents the paradox. On the one hand, she has crusaded against speech constraints as applied by what she sees as the woke. On the other hand, she says that Ilhan Omar is an anti-Semite because she said, you remember the episode with It's All About the Benjamins? Yeah, she was asserting that a congressperson's vote had been in response to money from a lobby. In this case, the lobby was AIPAC. She may have been right, she may have been wrong, but it seems to me to call that anti-Semitic. I mean, even if you want to argue that, okay, but there is this anti-Semitic trope about Jews, there being some conspiracy to control politicians and everything. I mean, I'm sorry if you see that relationship between what Ilhan Omar said and crazy conspiracy theories, but to say that a congressperson is influenced by a lobby is just not crazy. I'm sorry. And, you know,
In the first instance, Benjamin refers to Benjamin Franklin, who's on the $100 bill. And so it's not Benjamin, the Jewish guy who happens to have that name. But beyond that, it's about money. And the implication, of course, is that Jewish money coming from Jewish people who are attempting to influence American policy is influencing the Congress. So it's not just that money is influencing the Congress. It's that money coming from Jewish people is influencing the Congress. Mm-hmm. That's what she's condemning.
Yeah, but it seems to me that that's an undue constraint on speech.
Well, it's ironic in the extreme, because money is coming from Jewish people to influence Congress. And if you believe John Mearsheimer and Stephen Walt,
if you believe AIPAC itself, they brag about their influence.
They brag about it. That's where I'm going.
go ahead.
Well, I was going to say that maybe this is mildly in defense of Ilhan Omar, God help me. If I'm an inner city congressional representative, and say I have a district in St. Louis or Atlanta or Houston or New York, which is mostly minority people. I'm a Democrat,
mm-hmm.
and I'm black, and I utter the wrong phrases. I express some sympathy with the Palestinian struggle. I have some criticism of Israel. There's a very good chance that I'm going to be facing an extremely well-funded primary challenge the next time I look around. And where's that money going to be coming from? Well, it's going to be coming from AIPAC or AIPAC-affiliated adjacent sources who have their interests, and they certainly have a right to express themselves according to the Supreme Court by using their money. But who speaks for those people who are their constituents, who are the working class and low income and minority people? And what do they actually think? This is not the people choosing their politician. This is the influencers choosing the politicians for the people. And I thought the point of the Voting Rights Act was that minorities were going to have representatives of their own choosing. I'm being a little flippant here, but only just a little.
Mm-hmm. By the way, I haven't seen the latest on this story, but you've probably read that Barry Weiss may wind up running CBS.
Oh yeah, I've heard about that big buyout. Corporate. Yeah,
Larry Ellison's son,
David Ellison. Yeah.
Yeah, after a lot of hard work as a billionaire's son, scrounged up the money to buy Paramount, which owns CBS. And so apparently, yeah, that might influence CBS News' coverage.
Well, let me say this. I think the free press that Barry Weiss has built after leaving the New York Times editorial page is a very impressive piece of journalistic entrepreneurship. I mean, I think she's done a good job. I actually read their content and, you know, it's a real organization. You can disagree with her about this or that, but I think some credit is due to, instead of, I mean, what is Nicole Hannah-Jones doing now? Does anybody know who she is?
Where is she still at the New York Times or not?
I don't know, but I think she's teaching at Howard. She is the progenitor of the 1619 Project. But I can imagine she and Barry Weiss would have locked horns a lot when they were both at the Times on opposite sides of the aisle. I don't know as much about this perhaps as I could, but I'm just saying her imprint, Nicole Hannah-Jones's and Barry Weiss's, if you say, the class of 2010 or whenever it was that they signed on at the New York Times, Barry's way out ahead. And not just because of nepotism, but because of her own resourcefulness.
Yeah, that's true. I could make some criticisms of free press, and I may within the next few sentences. I would also say, it's impressive. I couldn't do it. I could not. Via any means whatsoever, build up a journalistic organization like that in such a short period of time. That said, she had a lot of money from people who I think were ideologically motivated and maybe largely by the anti-woke thing. But I mean, she got money from Andreessen Horowitz. Andreessen Horowitz does not invest, you know, as part of its normal portfolio in journalistic outfits that may someday hope to break even, which is the kind of thing she's running. I would also say, for the same reason, I don't think ordinarily Paramount would pay $200 million for something whose balance sheet looks like, I suspect, Free Press is actually.
I've heard that criticism. The numbers don't add up.
No, and I'll also say there was this one piece. I'm sorry, I shouldn't get it, but there was this piece they ran, Free Press ran, called "I Was Stabbed in the Eye Because I'm a Jew," and there were some problems right away with this. Which one of which was the woman who wrote it showed up on TV almost immediately, and you couldn't even see like a nick anywhere around her eye. Okay, but and then some video emerged. There was a demonstration at Yale. There was a pro-Palestinian demonstration. Then some video emerged of what had happened, and some Palestinian guy was like waving a flag back and forth as he marched forward. And then the smartphone camera that took the video was very close to where this woman had been, because you could hear her say "ouch" or something. And it's possible that the flag, that he was waving it intentionally kind of in their faces to piss them off or something, because they were identifiably pro-Israel or something. But it's just, you know, I had Paul Bloom on my podcast said he didn't even think it was intentional. In any event, there's just no way this was being stabbed in the fucking eye. I'm sorry. And they never issued a correction. It became increasingly clear it wasn't true. They never issued a correction. They finally changed the headline to something like, I was stabbed in the eye at Yale. But, you know, am I making too big a deal out of this? Look, I admit, I'm sure part of it is jealousy because nobody has bestowed on me however much money they bestowed on Barry Weiss for the Free Press to start the Free Press. Although, again, I admit I couldn't do I would waste it in a way she hasn't. I would fail. But am I making too big a deal? It was just so ridiculous as the truth
sounds
came
like
out.
You're serious about journalistic standards and you object to seeing them disregarded.
Yeah. Well, thank you. That's very nice of you to put it that way, as opposed to accusing me of being beset by rank jealousy. So, I don't know. Anything else? It seems like we haven't really, I guess, so look, the speech code is changing in many ways. There's an irony in many ways that make the code itself less constraining, the code surrounding Israel. You can say apartheid, you can say a few other things. And yet the enforcement mechanisms seem to me to be getting more draconian than they used to be, if that makes sense.
Largely at the hands of the Trump administration. You think they're overplaying their hands, that the enforcers are going to be surprised at the extent to which their influence wanes as people, object to the, don't believe your lying eyes, don't cross this line, whatever. I mean, can they end up, overdoing it?
I mean, it's hard to say. I'm more cynical than I used to be about money and power ultimately prevailing.
We were talking about Charlie Kirk.
Mm-hmm. In that first part of this, and that part will have been posted as a separate conversation, but yeah.
Okay, yes. In a previous conversation, we were talking about Charlie Kirk, and I remember seeing, I just did a little bit of looking into Charlie Kirk after he was shot, a conversation he had with Megyn Kelly, which they were complaining about, they're both strong supporters of Israel and have been demonstrating that in their podcast over time. But they had a question or they had a deviation of thought of one sort or another, and they found a ton of bricks falling down on them from Israel-friendly sources as a consequence of that, and they had it up to here. And that kind of backlash is, it seems to me, a latent potential for the speech code enforcers.
Yeah, I think there's definitely more openly expressed resentment about the speech code and the enforcers. A lot of it in the a certain amount of it in the MAGA right. Steve Bannon, as you said, Charlie Kirk. Now he had traditionally, I think, been a very strong supporter of Israel, but
yeah.
He was doing, I guess, some soul searching or something. Tucker Carlson had you on his show to tell, in part, one of the things you told was your story about the Manhattan Institute. And, that may be, in terms of affecting the current policies that enforce a speech code to the extent that they do, which is to say Trump's policies. I mean, he's pretty much that will be more significant than whatever is happening on the left, that you're getting this pushback from parts of the MAGA coalition. That said, Trump so far seems completely unwavering in his support for Israel. I mean, if it's true that Israel did not give him a heads up, did not ask what he thought about attacking Qatar, And it's already business as usual, which it is. I mean, he's going through the motions of saying, you know, we're really upset. Well, he says the same thing about Biden. Oh, Joe's really upset now. And you know, look, if you're really upset, you've got a big lever. You provide the weapons, okay? If you're really upset, you got a way to show it. And if it's true that Israel, that Bibi Netanyahu pays basically no price for attacking a country with an American military base in it and not giving us a heads up, then, you know, Trump's support for Israel just seems unshakable. And he's been very honest about how transactional it is and about how much money he got from Miriam Edelman and how she would come into the Oval Office and ask for things for Israel. And he'd say, Miriam, I already gave you X, Y, and Z, and she'd want more and blah, blah, blah. So I don't know. Now, that's a separate issue from the speech stuff. I certainly don't see any signs that Trump is letting up on that or on the pressure he's putting on the universities. You'd know before I would. You're paying more attention to that realm. So,
no, I think you're right.
I don't know. Now, I don't think it's good for Israel in the long run. Because, you know, there are significant generational differences and old people eventually die. But right now, there's a huge amount of power and money concentrated among the older generation that I think is intent on keeping things the way they've been. So we'll see. I don't know. Any closing thoughts?
Well, thanks for conversing with me for two of your episodes. I am grateful for the opportunity, and I look forward to hearing the conversations at some remove.
Well, I appreciate you taking time. I know you're busy. Do you want to tell us what you're busy with, or is it just the usual?
Well, there's a conference at the Hoover Institution where I'm a distinguished visiting fellow in October, honoring the great economist Thomas Sowell, who is a fellow at the Hoover Institution, and he's 95 years old. He's published dozens of books about social inequality and race and culture, and also about political philosophy. And he's in the classical liberal spirit that one associates with people like Friedrich von Hayek. I'm tasked with helping organize the conference and producing a paper to talk about his work. So that's what I'm focused.
Just have ChatGPT write the paper, Glenn. in fact, have it organize the conference. Get the premium version. Pay for the premium version and have it organize the conference. Someday, maybe. Well, thanks so much, Glenn. And everybody should buy your books, Late Admissions and Self-Censorship. That's the actual title, right? Not just the subject?
Yeah, that's the title, Self-Censorship.
And they should check out the Glenn Show. And we will see you down the road.
Thanks, Bob.